What's this called?
Vamping.
What is it do?
The year was 2013. In the back area of a children's bookstore in Brookside, with giant paper mache sculptures hanging from the ceiling, a bunch of kids were riveted by a performer on a makeshift stage. Playing the accordion before their very eyes was none other than Lemony Snicket, the popular children's book author. That sound you hear, the one you could easily mistake for the flapping of giant wings, is actually the sound of audience participation. Every time Lemony Snicket tells the kids to run, they pound their feet on the floor with a fury and vengeance. This was part of the Reading Reptiles DNA Lit Fest, an annual festival that brings in the big names in kids' books. Reading Reptile has been hosting events like this for a long time, and the store has developed a following of regulars, groupies even, because its playfulness is so sincere it's almost impossible to resist. Well, the Reptiles, that is, bookstore owners Deb Pettit and Pete Cowden, are on to a new adventure, one that's more about experiences than sales, and the hope is it's going to make Kansas City a hub for children's literature. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're going to get to know the Reptiles on KCUR's Central Standard. They're here with me now. Hi, guys.
Hey, Hi, Gina.
Your new project is called The Rabbit Hole, and it's a realization of a dream you've had for a while. What's the idea behind The Rabbit Hole, Pete?
So The Rabbit Hole is going to be the world's first Explorastorium.
Explorastorium.
Which is very hard to say. It's going to be... The easiest way for us to explain it is if you've been to the City Museum in St. Louis, is to imagine if that crashed into the Reading Reptile. So we want to create a epically immersive environment dedicated to the children's book.
What is it that you can do at the Rabbit Hole that you haven't been able to do within the limitations of a retail venture? Because I'll be honest, the Reading Reptile never has seemed particularly limited by anything. I mean, not adhering necessarily to expectations. It's always felt like you guys were doing whatever you wanted in there. I mean, I've seen indie rock performances with crowds that were like 50% little kids and 50% people I saw out at bars.
I don't think we've ever pulled a punch at the Reading Reptile. That's true. We've always been in love with the art of the book and the beauty of story and trying to have as much fun as we can. We've never been super interested in retail, but it was a way for us to express ourselves and to honor this amazing history and culture and practice of writing and illustrating children's books. So, yeah, we've had some wild events that are some of which I can't mention here.
Why not, though?
No, I can. We've just gone places where most retail stores don't.
For example?
We've had a funeral for Harry Potter after book four. That was pretty unexpected. It was one of our best events, however. We had Ron McGee of Late Night Theater and his crew came in, and to be kind, they interpreted a script I wrote about the elder Harry Potter who had died, and Hermione and the family sitting around wondering how they can revive the franchise, and they're all broke now. And so when the curtain went up for that at midnight, I forgot the year. There were 200 people in our store, most of them children, waiting eagerly. And all of a sudden the curtain came up and there were several guys in drag as Hermione and several other characters.
How did kids respond to this? I mean, there are so many layers of things that kids, I would think, would maybe that would be unexpected as far as what a kid's audience might expect out of a Harry Potter event. I mean, first of all, that you're fast-forwarding to tragedy in the lives of these characters, and tragedy that's sort of self-aware of the publishing industry,
right,
and the film industry. And then also there's the whole drag thing.
You know what? The fact of the matter is all they were there for was to get the book. You know, so they were a captured audience, but I will say they had a great time. They had it was one of the best events we ever had. And once the Ron and the guys started singing, and it was a musical, so we had kids singing along, and it wasn't all dark, but the premise was dark, and it was a bit cynical about the industry. You know, that book changed a lot of things for a lot of people, including authors and illustrators, in terms of marketing and how books are treated and what quality means in literature. Harry Potter books were very good, but they did have an adverse effect, I think, on what publishers ended up doing to sell books. And there was a lot of Debbie could talk about that a little bit, too.
Please do, Deb.
Well, I was actually going to shift to a different event that we had.
Yeah, please.
Which was an event that we did for John Shesk and Mac Barnett with a book that they had recently written together called Battle Bunny. And at one point, when people walked in, it was set up very Martha Stewart-y. We really kind of went all out with balloons and presents and peanut cups and everything. And
It was a birthday party.
It was a birthday party for Battle Bunny. And
Battle Bunny is the protagonist of the story.
He's the protagonist, yeah. And at one point, Battle Bunny raises his birthday cake, which was a very large sheet cake, over his head and smashed it on the ground. And a friend of ours, her child, looked at her and said, "Is this safe?"
Like, as in, am I safe here?
Am I safe here? Or is this funny?
I was the bunny.
But kids went crazy. It was so funny. They were just shocked and then went crazy.
Yeah. Because this is a thing that is just not done in the world of kids. I mean, really, in any world, like baking a large cake and then smashing it to the ground.
Right.
Well, and to give a little context, so John Shesky wrote that book. He's the author of The Stinky Cheese Man, a very beloved book that really changed a lot of things for the good in kids' books back in the 90s. But this book, Battle Bunny, was kind of making fun of the sort of bucolic golden book. So it starts out, you know, it has the pictures of a golden book, but then John and Mac Barnett corrupted it with their own drawings like kids do. So if you imagine like a kid taking a book and just turning all the characters into characters they want them to be and not what they really are. So it was a very funny book that actually gave us all the leverage and opportunity we wanted to goof around and twist things around. Kids had seen the book before, but it still shocked them when the Battle Bunny came out and attacked the cake. And John Shesky still tells this story over and over again because, you know, they go on tours all over the world. And what we did for that book was unique. And I think we take a lot of pride on, you know, beyond doing crazy things, is it's really an honoring the author's work, taking the work and really treating it seriously, even though it might not be serious. We look at books as an opportunity, you know, to share the culture with kids. And by doing something outrageous with a book, you know, it allows kids to think about the stories in different ways and also meeting the authors. So our contact with authors is really one of the big reasons that we're turning our attentions to the rabbit hole, actually.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the rabbit hole, but before I do, I mean, this whole idea of this smashing a cake and then a kid in the audience wondering if he's safe, and the idea that this is a way of honoring the art form, and that the kids went crazy in general. I mean, the one kid was afraid, but in general, the kids are going crazy over this, having a great time. What is it that you think you're tapping into, either about kids or about literature, that maybe not everyone has quite identified?
I think a lot of it is creating an experience, something that is unique for them at that moment that they are sharing with others, and recognizing that we as adults are taking something that they love and making it as wonderful and memorable for them as we can.
Well, it seems.
I was going to say, I think what you're getting at too is that the culture in general doesn't really take kids' books that seriously. So when you see them treated in reviews and there's really no such thing as children's book criticism, but in reviews and the ways retail stores handle them, it's always carefully and with kid gloves. There's always a sort of preciousness to kids' literature that allows us to sort of ignore them in a way. Like to if you read kids' book reviews, and we have many for many years, you know, the main words that come out of that are delightful. And, you know, a kid's book, if there's so by treating it basically with maybe irreverence, or that it is actually a form of reverence, because it's saying that this book is actually, we can talk about this book in many ways and we can experience it many ways. And it's not just something that we have to treat with a saccharine sort of cultural identity, which I think that's another reason. I mean, would you agree with that?
Yes.
Nice. Well put.
I mean, yeah, and part of this is I think that people might assume that a couple that runs a children's bookstore is kind of maybe a saccharine sweet pair that loves sugar and spice and all things nice or
and
something
bunnies.
Like that. Yeah, and bunnies. Mm. No offense, but that is not you guys. Your store sells stickers that say, read, damn it. So obviously no preciousness around language. And Pete, you've got this alter ego, A. Bitterman.
I do.
And through him, you've plunged into a lot of Kansas City art world controversies. I guess I'm saying that I don't know if there is a children's bookstore owner stereotype, but if it is, you guys defy it. I mean, does it feel like a contradiction to you? And does it ever feel like a contradiction to your customers?
Only sometimes. We don't really look up that much. I mean, yeah. Honestly, you know, A. Bitterman, by the way, is out in the waiting room if you want me to bring him in.
Get him. I don't know if we can tolerate his language.
Yeah, he's pretty, you know, he's not doing well this morning. But I don't think we do look up that much. I mean, I know we're different. We received a big award in the industry several years ago, and we had a lot of fun with that. And you know, in that case, we went out to New York, and there's a room of 800 people in the publishing industry, and basically we read a manifesto of sorts to that crowd about the sort of decline of kids' books in the commodity culture, and that kind of calling out, like, Katie Couric is not a kids' book author. You know, we said, you know, Bill O'Reilly's not a kids' book author.
So, like, celebrities who just toss out a kids' book,
but
they're not,
you know,
kids' book authors.
Yeah, and we have to get rid of this notion that anybody can write a kids' book. It's simply not true, and it diminishes the culture of children's literature and the rich, rich history and the legacy of the art and language of story, and that's what we're, you know, that's where we're moving forward to, I think.
Well, I want to get back to this question of your new project, The Rabbit Hole, but this question of what can you do in your new project that you weren't able to do through The Reading Reptile?
I think we can really show and demonstrate the history and the connectivity and the strength and beauty of children's literature in a way that's a lot different from a bookstore.
How is it different? I mean, take people through it who haven't even been exposed to your vision. Walk people through that vision.
Well, I think I look at The Reading Reptile visually, because that's often the first thing that people see when they come in, is just a visual component of it. And I really think of The Reading Reptile more as a statue garden.
It's full of papier-mâché mm-hmm. characters from popular children's books.
Yeah, and, you know, we've just covered everything, top to bottom. But it really is kind of a statue garden. And so the connections between things are more surface. And The Rabbit Hole is an opportunity to create really deep, meaningful connections and introduce people to somebody's body of work, or their relationship to the art world, or their relationship to the world of architecture.
So people will be traveling through, like, immersive galleries.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, basically, we're in our final form. We will have a building that will be between 50 and 100,000 square feet. again, hearkening back to other institutions like the City Museum in St. Louis, which is a big inspiration. We're not remaking the City Museum, but we're going to definitely employ a lot of that immersive love and energy. Exploratorium in San Francisco, which is a science-based, project-based institution, is another big inspiration, as our endeavor will be very project-based. The Rabbit Hole is a big, big, big idea, and it's a nonprofit, and it's a cultural institution, and most easily thought about as a children's book museum, but it's not a museum. It's a living thing. We'll be collaborating directly with authors and illustrators, and inside of this place, when you walk in, it's going to just seeing it is going to be a revelation. Suddenly, you're going to be in a place that is bedazzled by installations, narrative installations based on children's books. Just walking into the place.
What children's books?
Anything from Madeline to The Snowy Day to Mike Mulligan to novels as well, older kids. This isn't just a young kid place. So the Rabbit Hole, and that's a subtext, we're appealing to parents and kids. It's not a fun, like, drop your kid off, look at your watch and play with your phone time. It's a share time that we're creating, where you walk into this place that it absorbs you, and you go on an adventure. But within that, there'll be two immersive galleries that will rotate out every 3 months. So we'll have six different single stories that are honored and created in full form on a 3,000-square-foot gallery, where you can walk through that story from cover to cover. And when you come out, you'll see original artwork from that book in another gallery. And you'll interact with it. Beyond that, you might go down to the Rabbit Hole Theater and see Paul Messner perform that book or another book by that author. If you're lucky, you'll see the author and you'll get to sit down and meet them and work with them. Authors will be coming in all the time. This is a complex. It's a hive of things going on with children, young people, teenagers, and adults. We want to do a studio residency on a printing press, or we're going to have a printing press and a bindery as well. So it doesn't exist, and it's never existed, but it's about to exist in Kansas City. And
yeah, where do things stand with it now?
As far as geography?
Geography and otherwise. I mean, where are you within this project of making this idea real?
We are. So we've been working on it for about a year and a half in earnest. This last year... We've received a lot of great grants. We've been doing it. Basically, we're in a quiet fundraising period, and we're going to launch a public capital campaign later this year. And before that, we're going to launch an Indiegogo, which will be in April and May. And that's about money and a building, but it's also about introducing our project to a national audience. And that's the other aspect of this project that's really huge, is that we're working directly. Our advisory board includes Lemony Snicket, it includes Brian Selznick, Kate DeCamillo, two-time Newbery Medal winner, former ambassador to young people's literature, Linda Sue Park, Lisa Campbell Ernst, Shane Evans. That's just the tip of the iceberg. And the real beauty and privilege of this project is that we get to work directly with the industry to create this place, and just, you know, it's going to be amazing. And like Debbie said, you know, it's going to connect history with contemporary practice.
I want to get back. We'll get back to this project before we go, but I've known you guys a long time. We're friends. We've even been collaborators on a few projects, but there's still a lot I don't know about you and about how you came to be these figures in children's literature that you are now. And some of our listeners, like, just don't know you at all. So can we back up to the beginning? How did you two meet?
I don't think you want to know that story.
Really? I think I do, though.
I shared a jail cell.
I'm not sure whether you're kidding.
Yeah, me neither. Debbie, you start.
Well, the short story is we met through a mutual friend. Pete proposed the first night we met, and I said yes.
Wow.
And then I went to art school, and I didn't see her for 8 months.
Okay. So during this 8 months, you're in art school. You're newly acquainted / engaged. What are you doing?
My fiancé.
Well, yes, I was a fiancé then. let's see. That was in September. December, I went home for Christmas and drove to Kansas City and signed a lease in Westport, because I decided to open a children's bookstore.
It was 1988.
I was working in kids' bookstores. But,
yeah, and you were working in kids' bookstores in New York?
In New York, uh-huh.
And that was, you worked in a famous
Eeyore's, which was an amazing place. And I don't know what the percentages are, but many, many, many people that worked there are still in publishing today. Brian Selznick writes. Steve Geck is a great editor at, I think he's at Algonquin right now. There's somebody who runs Bank Street Books in New York. So, like, it was really an amazing place to work.
How old were you then?
24, 25.
What had drawn you into children's literature at that stage in your life?
The need for a job. I didn't know that there were kids' bookstores, and I needed a job. And I read a lot when I was a kid.
And what was it about the experience that really grabbed you?
I just the intensity of it, and the need to know as much as I could about the books that I was selling.
Well, it was also, you need to know, in New York, obviously, real estate's at a premium, so that it was a very small store, but it was packed with books.
It was packed.
And you had to work in this small space with a million books and people like Mia Farrow wandering in, and you know, if she needs, you know, a new book for her new three kids or whatever. You know, I mean, literally, like on the spot. That's how you describe it.
Yeah, and I literally just went from section to section and would take books home every night, and I just read everything.
You must have loved it, or else, I mean, it seems unlikely that you would have come to Kansas City and set about opening up your own shop.
I did love it. I loved the text. I loved the imagery. I didn't know anything about the history of it at that point. I didn't even have a vision as to what I wanted to do. My goals when I opened the store was I just wanted to make the best bookstore ever.
And you did that in Westport at the time in 1988. Mm-hmm. I remember that the materials, the promotional stuff for the store used to say in dangerous Westport.
Yeah.
Talk about what the location of that store meant to you in its first incarnation, the first Reading Reptile in Westport.
Well, it was exciting because I know a lot of the growth of the Reading Reptile was just kind of very organic and serendipitous. We didn't really have a plan, and we were able to.
Yeah, that's one way to put it.
We just tried different things.
Well, I don't think we were just having fun. We were 24, six, 5.
Pete, when did you finish art school and jump on board?
Well, that's a whole nother show, Gina, of course, because I was expelled from art school. I destroyed some property at the school that was very valuable. But beyond that, you know, I ended up in the Twin Cities, and Debbie ended up coming through St. Paul on her way down to Kansas City to open the store. And that was the second time we met. And that's where we confirmed our deep love for each other. Within that, we had 7 days for that. So that was kind of an epic time.
It does sound like a conjugal visit.
Yeah, I mean, should I press the cough button or something? That's conjugal. Can we say that? Anyway, no, we had a great time, and we had a mutual friend. Actually, the fellow who introduced us to New York was with us. He had come out from New York as well. And we just had a really great time, and we were talking about the store, and Debbie needed some help, you know, building some stuff. So I ended up going down to Kansas City, you know, every other week or whatever, just to build stuff. Ooh, that was a close one. We just had a blast. And we were just doing stuff. I mean, it wasn't, you know, we learned about books, you know, like Deb said, it was very organic. We just threw ourselves into it. We weren't, I mean, I wake up every day still and wonder, like, how I got here. But, like, you know, so I couldn't tell you, right, what the, there was just this sort of natural attraction between the art form of children's literature and then us being artists as well and being able to express ourselves through that. And to we had so much fun. And Westport was fun because it was a bar district at that time. Westport's gone through, and it is now, but people don't know that back then it was just coming off the Prospect. It was just closing. And then before then, it was kind of an adult area where people went to have fine dining and stuff. And then it turned into this pretty debauched bar district through the mid-90s, early and mid-90s, and then it started coming around again at the, you know, we could talk about Westport forever, but point is a lot of people had problems with it from a suburban point of view, but they still loved the store, and they would come down for events, but that's why we ended up putting Dangerous Westport, because we kind of got tired of, like, this idea that it was like, you know, people talk about places in town, like they can't go there because, you know, they still do. I mean, they still talk like that, but we were just making fun of that. Like, that was just silly.
There were, you obviously, as fiancés at this point, you did not yet have children, but you now have a lot of kids, and I wonder if they were part of the vision from the beginning, because your kids, and it seems like so many others, have grown up in this store. And in that sense, it's a family place, although our listeners are probably already getting the idea that it's not like rated G necessarily.
I think they became a part of the vision, or maybe even an opportunity. It was, again, just really natural. We have five kids, and they all grew up at the bookstore, and so it just offers a different experience to people, and it let us see things through different eyes. And
yeah, we didn't like consciously look at the kids like guinea pigs or anything, but they probably were, I guess. But we had fun, and gave us more through their friends and the friends through the store. We, especially in Westport, we did a lot of theater. Created lots of scripts, and when authors came to town, we'd always build some weird event around it that could be a full-on theater thing. We did a wedding for a Count Olaf when the first Lemony Snicket book came out, which was great. And I think we totally kind of shocked Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket. And that's what, you know, that's what really brought us close to a lot of the people, the creators in the industry over the years. I mean, they, you know, created some really fond memories, not just for ourselves, but for them. Again, when you're traveling around different schools and stores, you don't get to that kind of treatment. So
they appreciated our efforts because they recognized that we took their work really seriously,
right?
And were willing to invest a lot of time and energy to create something that was unique.
Pete and Deb, owners of the Reading Reptile, I'm curious about whether you think of your audience as being united by their age group because it is a children's bookstore, or by something other than age? What is it that you see as your audience, your readership?
I think it's people that are united by story.
Well, I don't think we have a readership. I think our whole lives are revolve around the book and that contact that book provides between adults and kids. So, like, the best culture, the best things. I was just reading about Pee Wee Herman and the revival of Pee Wee Herman. You know, that show, again, just brings to mind that notion where anybody can watch it. You could be 3 and love that show, and you could be, you know, 63 and die laughing. Like, because there's so many layers. And I guess people are people. I mean, in the end, I mean, of course, kids are going to, grasp one thing and not another. But you know, the experience that happens around the book is what counts. And that's, again, with the Reading Reptile and with the rabbit hole where we're going. There's a problem in society. People don't read to their kids regularly. Only 50% of parents read to their kids. And yet there's a ton of research. I mean, it goes on and on about how important that is, that parents read to their kids, and what a huge boost it is, and what great importance it is. And so why aren't we doing it? It's a simple thing to read 30 or 40 or 60 minutes a day, and it opens up not just worlds, but the cognitive development things that don't happen without that. And so that's our audience. Our audience is the book and what it can do.
I'm an adult who's been coming to your store. I think I'm an adult who's been coming to your store for a long time in spite of not having kids. And our listeners don't know this yet, but I am expecting A Child in June. As a longtime visitor to the Reading Reptile, I'm a little sad because it seems like just as your new project is getting off the ground, the old one, the Reading Reptile, might be tapering off. And I don't mean to be selfish about this, but I was just finally about to be a customer with an actual kid and not just the lone weirdo hanging out in a children's bookstore. So what is the deal and why are you doing this to me?
Yeah, it is selfish.
Thank you.
Sorry, man. Well, the good news is you get to look forward to the rabbit hole in your child's prime. You will be having the most fun you've ever had, and you will have a bookstore. So the bookstore is going to reappear in the rabbit hole. There's no shortage of bookstore interaction that you will have. And the great thing is, so the center itself, the rabbit hole itself, is going to have all these things to offer, writing labs and just going through the galleries, seeing art, you know, culture, theater. But you're going to also be able to do the bookstore programming, right? So you can come just for story time to the rabbit hole at the bookstore. You could do a book club or so those things will still be offered.
KCUR Central Standard has to take a quick break. When we return, we'll get right back to this conversation with Pete Cowden and Deb Pettit, owners of the Reading Reptile and soon the Rabbit Hole. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And yes, you heard me right earlier when I said I'm expecting a baby in June. But anyway, today's guests are children's bookstore owners Deb Pettit and Pete Cowden, also known as the Reptiles. Their store, the Reading Reptile, has been an anti-establishment in Kansas City for 27 years, and now it's evolving into a new project called the Rabbit Hole. You might have seen a storefront having to do with that on Southwest Boulevard. It's the one with a papier-mâché doorway. Hi again, Deb.
Hello, Gina.
And hi, Pete.
Hey, Mom.
Nothing flies under the radar with you guys.
Nope.
The papier-mâché thing seems to be like a serious medium for you guys in the Reading Reptile, and now there are already hints of it that you can see on the facade of what is currently the Rabbit Hole. I don't know if that's your eventual location or not.
No, but that's a temporary space where we have workshops and offices. And so we're an itinerant organization in search of a building right now.
So papier-mâché, I mean, you are able to use papier-mâché to transform two-dimensional images in a lot of different children's book illustrator styles into three-dimensional characters who are totally recognizable to anyone who has seen those books. Deb, I believe that this is kind of your territory, and I'm curious how you developed this very specific skill.
I just started making them. We started in the store in Westport. We would make one a year, usually with a group of kids. And when we made the transition to the Brookside shop, we had a crew of people, and we decided to make many and have that be a real key component. And I think with anything that you do a lot of, you just get better and better at it. And for me, it's often the combination of learning little tricks with building armatures or papier-mâché itself. But before I can even do that, I have to just be so comfortable with the character that I'm creating that I feel really good about making it into a three-dimensional. Because I don't want anybody to say, is that Goodnight Gorilla? I want, you know, whether it's a kid or an adult, to say, that's Goodnight Gorilla.
So, like, you know this character so well in your mind that your hand can then execute it like it's your own vision?
Strangely, sometimes, yes.
I call Debbie the great forger.
I am a great forger.
Lucky for painters, she's not working in two dimensions.
So yeah, I mean, I don't want anybody to think of it as my work. I want everyone to think of it as that is that character come to life.
Do you have a favorite papier-mâché character who has inhabited your world?
Well, my favorite one that I've made, I think, well, for lots of reasons, is Francis from Bread and Jam for Francis or Bargain for Francis.
Can you briefly tell us the basic crux of that story?
There are many stories about Frances. She's a little badger. She's fairly outspoken. She loves to jump rope. She likes to eat bread and jam. She's sings a lot and makes up a little poems. And I just love her spirit.
Russell Hoban wrote that book, and he was also an adult writer for adults, a British writer, I believe.
Yeah.
And the voice, like whenever we're showing people children's literature, especially picture books, if you want to hear dialogue in the kid, you know, with that has the tune of a child's voice, that's where we go. That's the beauty, one of the big beauties of the book. Russell Hoban is a good example, too, of a lot of authors who write other books besides kids' books and are known for them.
So Frances especially brings, like, there's something about this sculpture that especially brings Frances to life, or you just love Frances?
The fur.
The fur, yeah. She's one of the few pieces I have furred after I paint, after I papier-mâché her. So
the Reading Reptile, like, for a long time has been, it seems like, increasingly about a physical environment, and almost like it is a theatrical set, whether there is a play going on there or not. What is it about creating a physical environment that is appealing to you in terms of how to explore a children's book? Because it sounds like that's a lot of what The Rabbit Hole is going to do.
Kids moving through space and through story, that's a very profound thing. And I think one of the big things about The Rabbit Hole, it's going to be great, is that people who like to read, can't read, don't read, will still enjoy the space and make discoveries in that environment that they wouldn't otherwise. And it really expands the conversation around literacy and experiencing story and what that means, I think.
Do you see this as kind of a way for the children's book to evolve past retail? I ask that because book retail is a big question mark in a digital age.
Well, the retail model for book selling is declining again, and Amazon just announced 350 physical stores are coming to America. So I think part of it was our transition has to do with that, but we also have been carrying this idea around for 20 years. We just want to go to the part, the ideas, and the art that we love. So I think with the direction we're going, this is the model as far as celebrating the book and story with kids and adults.
Pete Cowden and Deb Petted, Kansas City's children book purveyors at The Reading Reptile and soon The Rabbit Hole. Thanks so much for joining me today. I'll see you guys soon.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Gina.